Yes, and welcome to my talk, Building a B Compiler for the PDP-8. This talk is the result of a term project in the Department of Media Science at Humboldt University. The very nice Mr. Papenhoff had a semester-long lecture on programming the PDP-8 from a historical perspective, because the PDP-8 is a historically very important mini-computer that basically defined this class of machine. And we learned how to program it and what kind of influence it had on modern computing designs. So I decided as a project to write a compiler for it, to get more familiar with the architecture and to show how this could have been done back in the day. We start with the B language. B is a procedural programming language which has been inspired by BCPL. It's basically BCPL with all the complicated bits cut out. So it could be implemented on a PDP-7 computer with limited resources. B was developed by Ken Thompson with assistance from Dennis Ritchie. And many of the modern aspects of the C language, which evolved from B, can already be found in B. And it's really much more resembling a C than it is resembling BCPL. I think the best way to introduce the B language is to make a C program and then to step by step added it into an equivalent B program, so you can see what has changed from B to C in a reverse kind of way. So we start with a very simple program that that computes the factorials from 1 to 10. And it's a very straightforward C program. That's ansi C. The first thing we notice is that B doesn't have a preprocessor, so we do not have include directives. B also doesn't have global declarations. So in C, if you want to use a function, if you want to use a variable, you have to declare it globally somewhere. And then the compiler knows what types it has and uses it. B doesn't have this. B basically has two simple tables, one for global identifiers, which isn't kept in the compiler, but rather kept in the linker for linking the program. And every function basically has its own little symbol table for all the symbols used in this function. This allows the compiler to get away with using much less memory, because it only has to remember the symbols used for one single function. So when you want to use an external symbol in a function, you have to declare it as extern inside the function. You can still do this in C. And when you have a look at ancient C code, like the Unix version 6 source code, you see this as a frequent design pattern. Extern used to be spelled without an E as well. The next thing is B doesn't have types. Types were a later invention in the C language, born out of necessity, because C was developed when Bell Labs got a PDP-11, fancy new machine, instead of the trusty old PDP-7. The PDP-7 is a word machine with an 18-bit word size, and B does not distinguish any data types at all. Everything is a word, and that just works out, because there's really not a point in having different data types when everything is a word. So for the change to the PDP-11, they figured out that this is really tricky to work with. So they patched the B language to have types. And this is what marked the distinction between B and C. So if we erase types from this program, we get something that already looks pretty much like a B program. Instead of declaring variables by type, we just write the keyword auto, which declares an automatic variable. This is a very innovative feature. Remember, B dates back to 1969, and the stack wasn't really established as a data structure for handling function calls. And B already supported automatic variables back in the day. So an automatic variable is created in the line where you write it, and it's automatically deallocated when the function returns. This also works through recursion. So you say auto I, and that was a very convenient feature. The next difference is main does not return something in B, so we do not need this return statement. B doesn't have a for statement. This was a later addition that appeared sometimes between the transition from B to C. It is not in my compiler. It is not in the original B language manual, so we don't use it. We have to use a while loop instead. Another difference we have is that in B, they had a much more simpler syntax, where you didn't have an equal sign after an initialization. So it's just I0 and F1. This was changed for C because it leads to syntactical ambiguities when you introduce types. The last difference we have is that in C, you have escape sequences with a backslash, and you have star equals for a short circuit operator, and you have this the other way around in B. They also changed this because it's really obnoxious to do and leads to syntactical ambiguities. But as we can see here, B is basically the same thing as C, and all the differences are really superficial, and it can be seen as a continued evolution of languages. And you can really see the heritage, and that most of the way the language fields was already nailed down in 1969. We still program this way when we write C code. So historically, B was a compromise. It was a way to have a procedural programming language on a computer that is actually not powerful enough to have one. So what they did was they did not compile B to machine code. Instead, they designed a custom bytecode, and the compiler would translate the expression trees in a B program into a kind of stack machine. So you have these stack operations that look a bit like PDP-7 machine code, except that the opcode is a pseudo operation that calls into a runtime library. So you have a B runtime library written in assembly, and the B compiler generates these stack operations. One thing that is very noteworthy about the way this works is that the stack containing all the variables and all the intermediate results has two stack slots for every variable. One stack slot is the L value, which is the address where the datum resides, and the other one is the R value, which is the datum itself if it doesn't have a dedicated memory location. This concept of having an L value and an R value for every single variable and object still exists in the C language as rudiments. It's still in the standard document, it's still in the implementation, it's still a very important conceptual model. And when you see operators like the dereference operator and the take address operator, then these directly manipulate these values. And we see this when we later have a look at the 8BC implementation. So now we come to the PDP-8, which is the computer I wrote this compiler for. And despite being a contemporary architecture and despite being an incredibly popular architecture back in the day, nobody has ever tried to write a B compiler for the PDP-8. This is very strange for me, so I thought this would be an excellent thing to do. You can see a number of PDP-8 computers in the exhibition. There is one at Oscar Vermeulen's booth. There's one at the Computer Museum Oldenburg, I think, and a bunch of other people who have also brought PDP-8s in the past. You can play around with it. It's a really nice machine. It's really instructive. The PDP-8 can be seen as a very early RISC computer in the sense that it only has 8 instructions. So the 8 instructions in the RISC computer, and big thanks to Angela Papenhoff for making this really nice instruction set reference. The PDP-8's 8 instructions are a bitwise AND, a 2 complements addition, an increment instruction that skips the next instruction if the incremented memory cell is 0, a deposit instruction that also clears the accumulator, a jump subroutine, a jump, an I/O transfer for doing I/O with devices, and an operate instruction. We will come to the operate instruction in a moment. As you can see from this instruction set description, we have a 3-bit opcode and a 9-bit operand in every single instruction. The 9-bit operand is a memory address, which can either be complemented with zeros to form a 12-bit memory address in the zero page, or with the upper 5 bits of the instruction pointer to form a memory address in the current page, where the currently executed instructions are. And we have an additional flag to perform an additional level of indirection as well. For the B compiler, the current page addressing modes are basically useless because it is very difficult to control which page code ends up on, so we don't use these at all. This leaves us with zero-page direct access and zero-page indirect access, which is very inconvenient for implementing procedural languages. We will see in a moment how this is done anyway. When you look at this instruction set, you see a number of very strange things. There's no load instruction. You cannot load a word from memory. So what you do is you first clear the accumulator, and then you add a word from memory to the accumulator. Because the accumulator initially contains zero, this effectively loads a word of memory. There's also no subtract instruction. If you want to subtract two numbers, you have to perform a 2's complement of one number and then add another. This is something the compiler has to do as well. And this way, all of the generally useful instructions can be synthesized from the available instruction set. This is greatly simplified by considering the operate instructions. The operate instructions are microcoded instructions, microcoded not in the modern sense of the word where a microprogram executes every time you have these instructions, but rather microcoded in the sense that an operate instruction really is a bit mask of instructions, and you can select any bits in this bit mask to execute at once. So, for example, if you want to perform a 2's complement, you first set the CMA bit for complementing the accumulator, and then you set the IAC bit for incrementing the accumulator. And as we all know, if you complement the bits in a register and then add one, you have a 2's complement, so a negation of the number. This is typically reflected by the CIA mnemonic, which is just an IAC microcoded with a CMA. Many other instructions can be microcoded as well. And the 8PC compiler makes great use of this fact. So, one thing we haven't noticed so far is there are no really useful conditional jumps. There's an increment and skip if zero, and it would be very terrible if we had to compare numbers by incrementing them until one of them rolls over. So there are indeed comparison instructions. The PDP-8 has a link register, which is basically a carry flag. It does not have any other flags, so sign comparisons are very difficult to perform, and I just decided to only work on unsigned numbers in the 8PC compiler. As you see, these jump instructions do not have an operand. They are just a single instruction, so they cannot encode a jump target. Instead, all these instructions skip the next instruction if the condition is met. So you basically encode a skip instruction, and the next instruction is going to be a jump instruction. And if the skip condition is true, then the jump is not executed, and if the skip condition is false, then the jump is executed, and execution proceeds from the jump target. This is a bit awkward to work with, but it turns out to be very easy once you get the hang of it. This operator too, as well, encodes some privileged instructions where you can access the switch register and hold the computer. We don't really use this in the compiler. We are now finished with the description, and let's get to the code and just have a look how it works. So, this is the source code of the B compiler, and we can go and have a look at some example programs. For example, if I have a Hello World program like this, PodChar, as you can see here, is a library routine that writes a character to the teleprinter. We do not have a standard library because I didn't implement one. So everything we want to do has to be synthesized from first principles. So to print Hello World, we print every character in the string until we are done. We can compile this program with the B compiler to get an executable, and this executable is in bin format. This is basically a PDP-8 bin format tape image, which you could punch on a 8-channel paper tape and feed into your PDP-8, and then you could execute the program. My computer really doesn't have a tape reader, and I don't have a PDP-8 either, so we have to use an emulator. Luckily, people have written very good emulators for these machines. And we can start the emulator from the SimH project. We load the hello.bin binary, and then we jump to address 200, which is the start address by convention. And this executes our program, and we see a printout. Now, we can see that the way this compiler works, it is very simple to just have a look at the assembly code it generates. So we tell the compiler to generate assembly code. And then we see the assembly code of the program. This starts with the B runtime, which is always the same and included from a runtime file. And then we eventually have the code of the program itself, which is pretty similar to how you would write assembly as well. So here's the main routine. Every function we have is encoded with a four-digit number and the letter L in front. This is because of shortcomings of the PDP-8 assembler, which only supports alphanumeric labels and only supports labels with up to 6 characters, since it's really difficult to deal with. Every high-level function written in B, let's get back to the function, where is it? Here. Starts with a call to the enter routine, which basically copies a template to the zero page, so we can access variables and temporary values on the zero page without disturbing other functions. And then the code is very similar to how you would write it in assembly. So first we load a number, which is in this case the initialization for our string. Then we write it into the string to initialize the variable. We load subsequent characters from the string, and then print it out by calling the parcha function. So how does this exactly work? We can have a look at this in a moment. We can step through the program in the emulator to have a look at this. Let's put some useful breakpoints in there. We should make a listen file as well. Paul, hello, bin. So here's the program listening. Let's make this a bit. So the main function starts at address 423. The first address in every function is a memory location reserved for the return address. And so we can break at 423 and then continue. And then when we step through the function, we see that it basically first calls into this entry routine, which we are not really interested in. Okay, this didn't really work. Oh. Maybe let's have a look at the source code of the compiler first. Sorry. So the way this compiler works is it's a very traditional Unix-like compiler design. We have a compilation pipeline where the source code is first split into tokens with a lexer. It's a standard lex-type lexer. Then it is parsed with a parser, and the parser directly generates machine code. And we can have a look at this here. So, for example, in the parser, when we have an addition, which is the plus instruction, the plus operator, then we generate, we call into functions in the compiler, which tell the compiler to emit instructions. And you see these functions have some resemblance to PDP-8 instructions, but there are some functions that do not clearly map to PDP-8 instructions. And this is because while the compiler directly generates code, it mangles the code it generates to generate more effective code. So this sounds a bit weird, but it's actually in principle very simple. So the LDA function, load accumulator, basically clears the accumulator and then adds a value to it. Behind this is a machinery which tracks the current state of the machine and does not emit instructions that it thinks it doesn't need to perform. So for example, if it knows that the accumulator is already clear and you try to clear the accumulator, then it does not emit this instruction because it is not necessary to perform any function. it doesn't emit any instructions whose effect it can immediately predict as well. So for example, if the accumulator contains a zero and then you increment it twice, then no code will be generated for this unless you try to use the resulting value. This makes it very simple to generate almost optimal code, because all the difficult parts of writing a modern compiler, like register allocation and storage management, are not really needed due to the simplicity of the PDP-8 computer. So we can basically directly emit instructions in the compiler and have them come out in the assembly, mangled and optimized. And this allows the compiler to stay very simple. Of course, for more complicated operations, we have to generate more complicated sequences of instructions. For example, for these comparisons, we have some auxiliary function which generates a complex instruction sequence to simulate the required semantics. And all of this then goes into the backend simulator, which simulates the instructions and generates the required code. That's a fairly simple and clear design. The resulting compiler is about 40 kilobytes in size and could realistically run on a 16-bit computers of the 80s, and maybe on a more expensive computers of the 70s. So it is a design that could have been used at the time when people wrote B compilers or early C compilers. We can have a look at some sample programs that illustrate this principle. So let me just go here. So for example, when I write a little demo test program that just adds two numbers, then we can see how this works. So the function first adds one of the numbers to the accumulator, then the other, and then returns. That's the simple part. So if we substitute this for maybe add one and then A and then B, then we see a simpler design where the accumulator is cleared and then incremented with IAC, increment accumulator, and then we add those numbers. And if I add another one, then we can see that the compiler can perform constant folding to first generate A2. This is done by setting the link bit, so the carry flag, and then performing a rotate through carry twice to rotate the carry flag into the bit at index 1, which corresponds to the value 2. So we load the accumulator with the value 2 and then add the two numbers. And this is possible because the backend, which simulates the state of the PDP-8, can simulate the effect of first adding one and then adding another one to the accumulator and compute appropriate numbers. We can also see that if we have useless statements in program, for example, if I have a statement that, for example, just computes 1 plus 2 plus 3 without doing anything with it, then the compiler doesn't generate any code for it because the simulation realizes that the code is not needed, and therefore no code needs to be emitted. We can also see that we can, if we, for example, perform a comparison, we see that a fairly long bit of instructions is generated. So we load B, then we complement it and add A to compute the difference, and then we branch on the result of this difference, and either we clear the accumulator or we set it to 1. And if we, instead of returning this value, want to perform a conditional action on it, then normally the compiler would generate code to the effect of we compute this condition, then we check if it is 0, and if it is not 0, then we perform the action in the if statement, and otherwise we skip it. But with the optimization, the backend can realize that these two conditional constructs can be fused into one, and the compiler can generate more optimal code. For example, if I do something like this, then you can see that only one conditional instruction is generated instead of the two conditional instructions we would expect. Of course, this doesn't always work. So for example, if I go here and confuse the compiler by generating weird code, then we once again have two conditional instructions and a much more complex instruction sequence. I'm not actually sure if this works if I just perform a complement like this. Yeah, if I perform a complement, then we still have optimal code like this. And that's basically, in a very simplistic fashion, how this optimizer works. It does not need to keep an internal representation of the code. It does not need to know anything about previous functions. It does not need to keep a very complicated state. And this, thus, can fit into a very small program. And this is much unlike previous compilers for this architectures. For this architecture and previous B compilers, and I think this is an interesting approach that is more reminiscent of modern compilers and how they work, except they are much more complex, of course. So we are at the end of this talk here. This is the project. You can find it on GitHub. It's open source. I'll just write the URL here. So you can find this on my website. So go to GitHub, and there you can find the source code. And I would like to know if anybody of you has questions about this project.
Why you have started this project 40 years after the BDP8?
I've started this project because I always wanted to do something like this, and it was a very convenient excuse to do a project. And I learned a lot from doing that. Writing compilers is not easy, and it taught me a lot about what kind of approaches you can choose. And I think it is important to understand how historical computers work even today, because we can learn a lot from them. This is not really a talk about the PDP-8, but we can see many of its design choices influencing modern computers. Mostly, the PDP-8 brought the genre of the minicomputer into the light. It was the first very popular minicomputer, and it showed people that there's a market for small application-specific machines with that are easy to program and that have a wide range of uses. And it was one of the first computers you bought to use in your lab setup instead of a large machine that many people would use. And I think it is important to not forget what the history behind this is and to work with these kinds of machines and to understand how they work.
Thank you.
So your compiler is written in C and uses tools like Lex and Yuck, I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
How much effort would it be to code the compiler not in C but in B itself and get bootstrapped?
It would be a bit difficult because the compiler is too large to fit into the memory of a PDP-8. So you could realistically translate it to be running on a larger machine, like a PDP-7 or a PDP-11. That would work. But it would be very challenging to make it work on the PDP-8 itself. You would probably have to split it into multiple parts or work with overlays or some other advanced construct. Incidentally, the design of the original B compiler for the PDP-7 was majorly influenced by these kinds of concessions, where they would implement new features into the language to make the compiler easier and shorter, but also a new feature would make the compiler more complex. So they had to work with this.
Oh, thank you for the answer. The background was back in the days I was assistant for doing teaching compiler construction. Mm-hmm. My favorite target platform was the MIPS architecture. And from what I've seen from your talk is that this single brain dead simple target is so much more attractive perhaps, and it would be really interesting these days to use, say, Oscar's Raspberry Pi based emulator as a PDPA substitute, and then have the students do the compiler works, the B compiler works on that thing. That would be very tempting, I guess.
So the PDP-8 is a very challenging architecture because it doesn't provide many of the facilities you need for modern procedural languages. So there's no hardware support for a stack. There are no useful addressing modes. Everything has to go to the zero page, and the compiler does a great amount of effort to move everything there whenever it needs it. And you also do not have bytes. So the PDP-8 is, as I said, a word machine with 12-bit words. Yeah. And it is very challenging to implement modern languages that assume a byte machine on a word machine. You run into similar problems as you run on an alpha, where every byte-wise access has to be emulated by shifting data around and moving it into memory cells. The same, of course, applies if you implement B, which is a word language, onto a byte machine, where you run into the problem that addresses do not increment in ones. Every word on a PDP-11 is 2 bytes, so the addresses need to count in word for B programs to work, but addresses on the machine count in bytes, so you have to do arithmetic every time you perform a dereference, and that's very annoying to do.
Okay, thanks for that explanation.
Any other questions? So then, thank you for listening to my talk, and I hope you enjoyed it.